It doesn't seem fair to anyone in this room that you have to now look at me for the next 25 minutes after that. Those kids have more talent in their pinky than I do in my entire body. It was really cool, like, you know, watching you guys. Like, I know a lot of you guys were getting super emotional and crying during their performance, and now you're crying for another reason because you have to stare at me, so I'm sorry for that. What I shared this last night, what I thought was one of the coolest parts of that entire thing is something you guys didn't actually get a chance to see. During the first two songs that just the worship team was out here, His Little Feet was not out here yet. They were back in our backstage in our green room. If you've ever been back in the green room, they have a huge TV back there that basically is showing the live feed of the service, the audio and all that type of stuff. And so while the worship team is singing, they have 22 kids in a room, and you would think that would be pandemonium, right? Because I have one child, and she's insane. But 22 kids in a room, and every single one of them was locked onto the TV singing along with the worship songs that were being played. They didn't have to practice there. They were not even involved in those first two songs, but they still wanted to worship. It was just such a cool experience watching that. So if we have not met, my name is Scott. I'm the student ministries pastor here. I just want to thank Pastor David for giving me the opportunity to speak. Him, along with a handful of our other pastors and about 100 other people, are over in Israel right now. I don't know how time works. It's either tomorrow or yesterday or they're in the future. I don't really know, to be honest with you. But I know a handful of them kind of just got there, but they had some baptisms, you know, a couple days ago, which was really, really cool to see on social media. So I would ask you to continue to pray for them and their trip over there. So we have been working through the book of John for these past couple decades, and we are very quickly getting to the end of the book. And the narrative of John, really the narrative of the Gospels, is really, really interesting at times. Because oftentimes what they will do is they will skip large chunks of time. They will skip days, weeks, or even months. And then they kind of just take their time on certain things to really emphasize it. And this is no more apparent in the book of John, where the first 11 chapters in the book of John covers 3 years of Jesus' life. The next 9 chapters of John cover 1 week. So 11 chapters for 3 years, and then 9 chapters for a week. You see, what John is doing there here is he's trying to slow down. He's trying to emphasize everything that's about to happen. He knows that these are the final hours, these are the final days of Jesus' life. And so he wants to make sure we are all getting it. We are all understanding the magnitude of what is happening. Last week, Pastor David talked about Jesus being arrested and Judas, one of his disciples, betraying Jesus. And Jesus has already been taken into custody. And from that moment, John begins to kind of shift the narrative from Jesus. He's been focusing a lot on Jesus these past couple chapters. And now he focuses it on the disciples, specifically Peter. And Peter, man, he's had a rough day. It is not going well, and it's about to get even worse. Have you guys ever had one of those, like, really, truly horrible days? I know a lot of times we go to, like, a tragedy. We go to, like, the death of a family member, those truly awful days. But what about those days where some of the mistakes, some of how bad it is, it's because it's your fault? Or you just sit back and you laugh at the comedy of errors that just took place in your life. I've been married for coming up on 14 years, and so about 13 and a half years ago or so, it was the week of my wedding, and I was driving down the 180 in my 1993 Ford Ranger. I know, you're jealous. I get it, all right? So I was driving down in my truck, and I was going about 65 miles an hour, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, you don't seem like the type of guy that goes 65 miles an hour on a freeway. And you are a good judge of character, all right? But I know for a fact I wasn't going more than 65 miles an hour because my 93 Ford Ranger, the speedometer stopped at 65 miles an hour. I couldn't speed if I wanted to, all right? So I'm going down the 180 and I hear this huge pop. And then and I knew, oh man, I just blew out a tire. Dang it. And so I pull off to the side of the road, kind of assess the damage. And this thing is absolutely tore up. It looked like a bear mauled the side of my tire. Like I knew I couldn't keep going on this. Like, you know, we've all had that before where you're like, I'm going to keep pushing this a little bit more. No, I couldn't do it. And so I start to get some stuff out of my truck and I go to basically change the tire. I get up underneath my truck to where my spare tire is. And I realize my spare tire is also flat because I'm not smart. And so I'm like, oh, man, I can't. What am I supposed to do here? It's later in the day. It's about 7, 8 o'clock. And I know there's no tire shops open right now. So I'm just going to have to leave this thing because I'm sure as heck ain't going to pay to tow this thing. That's going to cost $200. The truck's only worth 20 bucks. Like, that's not a good use of my money. You know what I mean? So I just leave it, and I'm just like, I'm just gonna park it here on the side of the road and just hope for the best. I'll come back in the morning. So the next morning, I get a spare tire, and I go back, and my window's busted open. Of course it is. It's Fresno. And my window's busted open, bunch of stuff stolen out of it. I'm just like, man, can this day get any worse? Within 12 hours, a blown-out tire, flat, spare, busted windows, bunch of stuff stolen. And I'm just like, what is going on here? But the week worked out all right. I still somehow tricked a woman into marrying me. I'm not sure how I pulled that off, but the Lord works in mysterious ways. But Peter, man, he was having a day. And not a good one by any means. We know from a little earlier in the story, earlier in the book of John and the other gospels, that Jesus and the disciples, they go to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus knows it's kind of his final hours, and he's feeling a little overwhelmed. He's feeling, you know, a little stressed out. He knows what's going to happen next. And so he just takes some time to connect with God. And so he tells the disciples, he says, I'm going ahead of you guys. I'm going to go, I'm going to pray, I'm just going to connect with God and align our wills right now, and I would ask that you just stay back and you would pray for me. Pray for everything that's about to happen. But we know from the Gospels of Matthew and Mark that the disciples, Peter included, they don't stay back and pray. They actually fall asleep. Strike one. Jesus asked them to pray, they fell asleep anyways. Last week, when Pastor David talked about Jesus getting arrested, we looked at the story of Peter chopping off someone's ear with a sword in the middle of being arrested. And I understand, like, times are different back then than they are now, but does it feel weird to anyone else that one of the disciples of Jesus just has a sword with him literally at all times? Like, if one of your buddies carried around a sword with you at all times, like, that would be very strange, right? You're going out to the club, you're going out to dinner, and your buddy Pete's like, hold on, let me go get my sword real quick. I got my sword. Guys, you'd be like, okay, we're not going anywhere with Pete, all right? Like, it's all bad. But he just chops off someone's ear right after he fell asleep when he was supposed to be praying. Strike one, strike two. And this is where we pick up our story today. Like I said, John has been focused exclusively on Jesus and what's been happening in his life and what he's communicating to the disciples in his final hours. But now he kind of shifts it over to the disciples. But remember, just a couple hours ago, when they were at the Last Supper, Jesus was sitting with his 12 disciples. And in the middle of the supper, in the middle of it, Judas gets up, leaves, and goes to betray Jesus. His 12 is down to 11. And then after Jesus gets arrested, we quickly find out that his 11 go down to just two disciples that stay with Jesus during his arrest. From 12 to 11 to 2, just in a span of a couple hours. So that's where we're picking up the story today. We're going to be in John chapter 18, starting in verse 15. If you have your Bibles, whether it's digital or physical or anything like that, I'd love for you to turn to John chapter 18, where you'll be kind of unpacking this story. If you don't have a Bible, don't worry about it all. Every single verse I read is going to be up on the screens for you. So John chapter 18, starting in verse 15, here's what it says. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus after he's been arrested. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside the door. Okay, so Jesus is arrested, and he's about to be paraded around in front of the high priest, in front of Pontius Pilate, a bunch of other people. And we see that Jesus is with Peter and another disciple. Why this disciple isn't named, we're not really sure, but who is this other disciple? As weird as it sounds, we can probably safely assume this other disciple is John, as in the author of this book. So he's writing about himself in the third person, and he does this all the time. It's one of those questions that when I get up into heaven, be like, John, what's going on here? What's the issue right here, all right? Like, he, other times in the Bible, he talks about himself as the most beloved disciple. Seems presumptuous, but that's fine, okay? It's like when you're giving a gift to your parents and you sign it like, your favorite and most beloved child. Like, that's how I write all of them. It's true, though. I am their favorite and most beloved child. But why does he do this? Well, we don't fully know. But we can safely assume that this is John for two reasons. One, we know from later, a couple chapters later, we know that the only disciple that is at the crucifixion, that is actually at the death of Jesus, is John. So if he's at the crucifixion, you have to imagine he's probably at the trial. He stays with Jesus the entire time. The second reason we probably can safely assume that this is John is we know from the book of Acts that John and the high priest, they know each other. Maybe they have a friendship. We don't know exactly how they know each other. But like this passage says, the high priest knew this other disciple. And in the book of Acts, John and the high priest, they know each other. So we can safely assume that this is John. So John heads inside to the courtyard, but Peter is left outside waiting. Let's keep reading. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, we get it, John, you know the high priest, came back and spoke to the servant girl on duty there and brought Peter in. So John goes in and he basically is like, well, hold on, where's Peter? I was just with Peter. And Peter got caught at the door. He wasn't on the bouncer's list. The doorman thought his fake ID. I don't really know what was happening, okay? But he's basically like, what's going on here? And so John, we assume, John is telling the servant girl, hey, I've got a buddy outside. His name is Peter. Would you go outside and would you grab Peter for me and bring him in? But this is where the story gets interesting. And this is where Peter's day goes from being really, really bad to even worse. Here's what it says. You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? She asked Peter, she being the servant girl. He replied, I am not. It was cold and the servants and the officials stood around the fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. So the servant girl goes outside and we don't know if she was actually accusing him of like, you're not one of those Jesus guys, are you? You're not one of his friends. Or maybe she was just asking like, hey, I got sent outside to find some guy named Peter. He's a disciple of Jesus. Are you him? Like, we have no idea what the servant girl's intentions are here. But Peter just flat out denies it. He's like, no, I'm not a disciple of Jesus. I don't know what you're talking about. That's not me. And the author of this book, John, we begin to see him set up this contrast between Jesus and Peter. You remember, this scene is all happening in the middle of the night. The Pharisees are hiding under the darkness right now. They don't want to make a spectacle of all this, not just yet, at least. Eventually, they will. But while the world is asleep, they are plotting the arrest and the torture and the death of Christ. And you can almost picture where these two men are, where Jesus is and where Peter is. And the contrast between these two men, you can imagine Jesus is over here. He's already been arrested. Maybe his hands are bound and the torture hasn't started yet, but you have to imagine they're not being very gentle with Jesus. Maybe they're pushing him around. Maybe they're mocking him. Maybe they're roughing him up just a little bit. And he's standing in front of the high priest, answering every single question that is asked of him, knowing how this night will end. And then over here, you have Peter. He's too afraid. He's too afraid to go inside. He's too afraid of what's gonna happen next. He's too afraid of the repercussions. Maybe he's thinking, I just chopped someone's ear off. They could arrest me. They could torture me. They could kill me. I'm so afraid of everything that's about to happen. And you have this contrast of what's gonna happen. The servant girl brings him, tries to bring him inside, and he denies that he's a follower of Jesus, and he lies. And maybe he's thinking to himself, well, I just lied. I can't run off. And so he starts to blend in with the crowd. He finds the servants, he finds the officials, and he basically kind of warms himself by the fire, trying to blend in, not trying to look like a disciple of Jesus that he actually is, but just trying to look like another guy, just another person standing there. You can imagine it was a cold night. There's frost on the ground. Maybe you can see your breath in the air. And while the Savior of the world stands trial for crimes he did not commit, Peter is warming himself by the fire. His lie, his denial has, for now, made him comfortable. It's made him safe. But like most lies in our life, they very quickly lead to another lie. We're going to hop down to verse 25 and finish off this passage. Here's what it says. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there, warming himself. So they asked him, "You aren't one of the disciples too, are you?" He denied it again, saying, "I am not." One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, the rooster began to crow. This is actually the last time we hear from Peter until Jesus comes back from the dead. Peter's awful, terrible, no good day is finally over. Jesus actually predicted that this was going to happen all the way back in John chapter 13. And even though Peter swore up and down that this would never happen, he did. He denied Jesus three times. And we see Peter overcome by fear, overcome by what is going to happen next, overcome by fear of the unknown. This person that he has spent every waking moment with for the past 3 years, he chose to abandon him. He chose to separate himself from Jesus. He chose to not stand next to Jesus during his trial. Simply put, Peter chose comfort over conviction. He didn't want his life to be put at risk. He didn't want to go through what Jesus was going through. So he chose to deny knowing Jesus, deny even being a follower of Jesus. And he chose to lie about the thing that he knows to be true. But he couldn't just stop at one lie. It wasn't just that one denial, that one lie. Lying has that snowball effect, right? We've all been there before where maybe we started off with one lie and it was just a little lie. It was just an innocent lie, but then it led to another and another and another. And we got so deep into the lie that we don't even remember what the original truth is. We just feel overwhelmed by these lies. He denies being a disciple of Jesus, denies even knowing who Jesus is because he's afraid of what man will do to him next. In this moment, Peter is more afraid of man than he is of God. He cares more about the approval of man than he does the approval of God. The Apostle Paul talks about this very concept in the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 1, verse 10, here's what it says. This is Paul writing. He says, "Am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Or am I trying to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ." Some of us know this all too well. Some of us in this room are people pleasers. We are so afraid of what others will think of us. We are so afraid of conflict. We are so afraid of letting people down that we actually sacrifice what God has called us to do. We are constantly wanting to seek the approval, seek the acceptance and love of others. We want them to value us. And we want that acceptance from friends, family members, coworkers, spouses, every single person in our life. And in those things of itself, those are not bad things. We were all hardwired for community. We're all hardwired for relationship. The community was part of the original design. But what happens is we now put that value of relationships, we put that above our relationship with Christ. And we want so badly to have the approval of others as opposed to the approval of God. We try to serve an audience of 8 billion as opposed to an audience of one. Let me ask you this question. What sounds more exhausting? trying to please 8 billion people whose hearts, minds, and desires change by the minute, or trying to please a God who is the same yesterday, today, and forever? But we try to keep both these plates spinning, and we wonder why it's not working. We're so confused, like, what's going on here? I'm trying to please God, I'm trying to please man, and it's just not working. And Paul says that if we are trying to please people, that he wouldn't be a servant of Christ. You cannot balance these two things. You cannot think that you're going to get the approval of others and think that God is going to be satisfied with that. Your people-pleasing, your constant desire for the approval of others is holding you back from a better relationship with Christ. But we default to what we think is safe. We default to trying to please our boss, please our friends, our in-laws, our spouse, and we hope that everything will work out. Well, you know what they say, happy wife, happy life. Okay, I'm gonna be very careful about what I say right here, and I want you to hear me on this, all right? Because I love my wife, and I'm just kidding, I do. Here's what I'm trying to say on this. God does not care about your happiness, and God does not care about your spouse's happiness. Here's why I know that. Your happiness is dependent on your circumstances in life, right? Things are going great, we're happy. Things are not going great, we're not happy. And God promises us in the Bible, he says, in this world, you will have trouble. You will. Not you might, you probably, possibly, maybe. No. You will have trouble. So if your life is going to be difficult, God is not telling you, yeah, your life's always going to be happy. He doesn't care about that stuff. He also says, in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overtaken the world. So he's telling us something greater. He's calling us to something so much better. And I'm telling you right now, guys, if you truly cared about your wife, if you wanted to love your wife and you wanted everything for her, you would pursue after Christ first and foremost. Everything else falls into place. You are called to love your wife. You are called to lead your household. You are called to sacrifice for your wife, not be so consumed with people-pleasing that we forget the calling that every single husband and father has placed on their life. God does not care about your happiness because he has so much greater plan for your life than just happiness. But we choose what we think is safe. The Bible also tells us that there's nothing safe about people-pleasing. There's nothing safe about pleasing man. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 25 says this. It says, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. Basically saying fear of man is a trap. The only thing that will actually keep you safe, if you truly care about safety, if that's what you want it to be, if you want to live a safe life or anything like that, you need to trust in God. And that is the trap that Peter fell into that night. He was so afraid of man. He was so afraid of what was coming next that he chose to turn away from God. He chose comfort over conviction. And some of us do the same thing every single day. Peter knew who Jesus was. He was there for the teachings. He was there for the healing. He was there for the life change. At one point in the Gospels, Peter actually confesses that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. He knows all this stuff to be true. He had that conviction. He knew who Jesus was. And we've all experienced this life change, but we continue to choose ourselves over Christ. And this is not me standing on stage and pointing the finger out in the crowd. This is me standing on stage and pointing the finger at myself. Because I choose myself every single day over Christ. And I don't want to be like that. I don't want to constantly desire the approval of man. I want to pursue after God. But I choose to turn away from him. I choose to turn away from his will. I choose to turn away from his plan in my life. And God has something so much greater for me. God has not called us to a life of comfort. He has called us to a life of holiness. He has called us to a life where we serve the world, where we serve others, and we sacrifice. But so often we just feel stuck in our sins. We feel stuck in our mistakes. We feel stuck in our denials. We feel stuck in our lives. And Peter probably felt the same way. I think there's a reason we don't hear from him until the crucifixion. You have to imagine he ran away and just didn't know what he wanted to do. But there's redemption in Peter's story. We don't have time for it this morning, but I would challenge you to go read the end of John chapter 21, where Jesus comes back and he actually restores Peter. He offers him grace. He offers him forgiveness. But then there's this really interesting passage towards the end of Peter's life. It's in 1 Peter chapter 5. After the biggest mistake of his life, the biggest three mistakes of his life, after the worst day of his life, God still gives grace to Peter. And Peter writes these words in 1 Peter chapter 5. He says, "And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong and firm and steadfast. And to him be the power forever and ever. Amen." The God of grace will restore you. But so often we just feel like we are stuck in the lies that we have. We're stuck in the denials. So often we feel like we are supposed to be defined by our worst mistake, be defined by our worst day, be defined by all the past terrible lies and sins that we have done. And God is telling us that it is not the case. You read the rest of the New Testament, Peter is an absolute rock star. This is not where his story ends. He is restored by God, and then he preaches to 3,000, he preaches and 3,000 people come to faith at the day of Pentecost. And then he starts churches and he writes to people and he encourages people, and still thousands of years we are unpacking the words of Peter. He could have left right then and there and be defined by all the mistakes that he made, but he chose to accept God's grace, even when he didn't deserve it, even when he knows, man, God is so much greater than my terrible ideas, than my terrible mistakes. So many of you feel stuck in your sin, and God is calling you out of that. God is calling you to redemption. It says in that passage that he wants to give you strength. Other versions say that he will place you on a firm foundation. I know the ground you are standing on right now feels real, real shaky. I know that to be true. But God is saying, I've got something so much better for you. I've got something so much greater than your comfort, so much greater than all of your lies, so much greater than your denials. I've got something that is truly life-changing. For everyone in here, I don't want you to be defined by your biggest mistake. I don't want you to be defined by your worst day. So I don't know what you need right now. I don't know if you need grace. I don't know if you need redemption. I don't know if you need prayer. I don't know if you need to step out of your sin and you need to step out of the darkness that you've been living in and say, look, I'm ready to get baptized today. I'm ready to turn around my life today. I'm ready to follow after God. I'm tired of choosing comfort. I'm tired of choosing all of my lies. I'm ready for something new. I'm ready for something different. If that's you, in just a second, we're gonna have pastors and leaders up here available to pray. Or maybe you're just thinking, man, I just need to be baptized. Come forward. Maybe today is that new day that you can have redemption and you can have grace. We're going to stand and we're going to sing. Let's go.